Lucian Wilbanks began his cross pleasantly enough. The two had hooked up before in trials. He made the pathologist admit that some of his opinions might possibly be wrong, such as the size of the murder weapon and whether the assailant was right-handed.
"I stated that these were probabilities," the doctor said patiently.
I got the impression that he had been grilled so many times nothing rattled him. Wilbanks poked and probed a bit, but he was careful not to revisit the damning evidence. The jury had heard enough of the cuts and gashes. It would be foolish to cover this ground again. A second pathologist followed. Concurrent with the autopsy, he had made a thorough examination of the body and found several clues as to the identity of the killer. In the vaginal area, he found semen that matched perfectly with Danny Padgett's blood. Under the nail of Rhoda's right index finger, he had found a tiny piece of human skin. It, too, matched the defendant's blood type. On cross-examination, Lucian Wilbanks asked him if he had personally examined Mr. Padgett. No, he had not. Where on his body was Mr. Padgett scraped or scratched or clawed in such a way? I did not examine him, the pathologist said.
Did you examine the photographs of him?
I did not.
So if he lost some skin, you can't tell the jury where it came from, can you?
I'm afraid not. After 4 hours of graphic testimony, everybody in the courtroom was exhausted. Judge Lupus sent the jury away with stern warnings about avoiding outside contact. It seemed overkill in light of the fact that they were being hidden in another town and guarded by police. Baggy and I raced back to the office and typed frantically until almost 10. It was Tuesday, and Hardy liked to have the presses running no later than 11 p.m. On those rare weeks when there were no mechanical problems, he could run 5,000 copies in less than 3 hours. Hardy set the type as quickly as possible. There was no time for editing and proofreading, but I wasn't too concerned about that edition because Miss Callie was on the jury and wouldn't be able to catch our mistakes. Baggy was hitting the sauce as we finished up and couldn't wait to leave. I was about to head for my apartment when Ginger McClure strolled in the front door and said hello as if we were old friends. She was wearing tight jeans and a red blouse. She asked if I had anything to drink. Not at the office, but that wouldn't stop us. We left the square in my Spitfire and drove to Quincy's, where I bought a 6-pack of Schlitz. She wanted to see Rhoda's house one last time from the road, not too close. As we headed that way, I cautiously inquired about the two children. The report was mixed. Both were living with another sister. Ginger was quick to tell me she was recently divorced, and both were undergoing intense counseling. The little boy appeared to be almost normal, though he sometimes drifted off into prolonged periods of silence. The little girl was much worse. She had constant nightmares about her mother and had lost the ability to control her bladder. She was often found curled in a fetal position, sucking her fingers and groaning pitifully. The doctors were experimenting with various drugs. Neither child would tell the family or the doctors how much they saw that night.
"They saw their mother get raped and stabbed," she said, killing off the first beer.
Mine was still half full. The Deese home looked as if Mr. and Mrs. Deese had been asleep for days. We turned into the gravel driveway of what was once the happy little Castlelaw home. It was empty, dark, and had an abandoned look to it. There was a for sale sign in the yard. The house was the only significant asset in Rhoda's small estate. The proceeds would all go to the children. At Ginger's request, I cut the lights and turned off the engine. It was not a good idea, because the neighbors were understandably jumpy. Plus, my Triumph Spitfire was the only one of its kind in Ford County, and as such was naturally a suspicious vehicle. She gently placed her hand on mine and said,
"How did he get in the house?"
"They found some footprints at the patio door. It was probably unlocked." And during a long silence, both of us replayed the attack, the rape, the knife, the children fleeing through the darkness, yelling for Mr. Deese to come save their mother. "Were you close to her?" I asked. Then I heard the distant approach of a vehicle.
"When we were kids, but not recently." She left home 10 years ago.
How often did you visit here?
Twice. I moved away, too, to California. We sort of lost touch. After her husband died, we begged her to come back to Springfield, but she said she liked it here. Truth was, she and my mother never got along.
A pickup truck slowed on the road just behind us. I tried to act unconcerned, but I knew how dangerous things could be in such a dark part of the county. Ginger was staring at the house, lost in some horrible image, and seemed not to hear. Thankfully, the truck did not stop.
"Let's go," she said, squeezing my hand. "I'm scared."
When we drove away, I saw Mr. Deese crouching in the shadows of his garage, holding a shotgun. He was scheduled to be the last witness called by the state. Ginger was staying at a local motel, but she did not want to go there. It was after midnight, our options were thin, so we drove to the Hocut place, where I led her up the stairs, over the cats, and into my apartment.
"Don't get any ideas," she said as she kicked off her shoes and sat on the sofa. "I'm not in the mood."
"Neither am I," I lied. Her tone was almost flippant, as though her mood might change real soon, and when it did, then we could have a go at it. I was perfectly happy to wait. I found colder beer in the kitchen, and we settled into our places as if we might talk until sunrise.
"Tell me about your family," she said.
It was not my best subject, but for this lady, I could talk. "I'm an only child. My mother died when I was 13. My father lives in Memphis, in an old family house that he never leaves because both he and the house have a few loose boards. He has an office in the attic, and he stays there all day and night trading stocks and bonds. I don't know how well he trades, but I have a hunch he loses more than he gains. We speak by phone once a month."
"Are you wealthy?"
"No. My grandmother is wealthy. My mother's mother, Bibi, she loaned me the money to buy the paper." She thought about this as she sipped her beer.
"There were 3 of us girls, 2 now. We were pretty wild growing up. My father went out for milk and eggs one night and never came home. My mother has tried twice more since then. Can't seem to get it right. I'm divorced. My older sister is divorced. Rhoda is dead."
She reached across with the bottle and tapped mine.
"Here's to a couple of screwed-up families."
We drank to that. Divorced, childless, wild, and very cute. I could spend time with Ginger. She wanted to know about Ford County and its characters. Lucian Wilbanks, the Pagets, Sheriff Coley, and so on. I talked and talked and kept waiting for her mood to change. It did not. Sometime after 2 a.m., she stretched out on the sofa, and I went to bed alone.